It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 42 degrees. A foggy mist is still hanging around. They are down to 4 miles of visibility at the airport, and they are registering southeast winds to 13, gusting to 24. Look for blustery southeast winds to continue through today, tonight, and tomorrow, gusting as high as 35 today, 45 tonight, and 50 tomorrow. Coming up on the Midday Report, the Kodiak History Museum has published an online photo database of many of the items in its collection. Two longtime King Cove residents have died from injuries sustained in a suspicious fire in Anchorage. And Alaska lawmakers are searching for solutions as the looming shortage of natural gas threatens power and heating for much of the state's population. That, plus it's been an especially active avalanche season so far. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Fear of more bloodshed and civilian deaths is building in the southern Gaza city of Rafah after Israel said it had rescued two hostages held by Hamas since the militant group's October 7th attack on Israel. NPR's Ada Peralta has more on Israeli strikes overnight.
NPR's producer in Rafah, Anas Baba, says Palestinians were awakened by the sound of explosions and gunfire. The Al-Huda Mosque was destroyed by an airstrike. Sanat Al-Kurd saw it.
Every day we lose everything. We lose our family, we lose our health, we lose our mosques, we lose our children and our houses. You know, where's the humanity?
Israel has warned of an upcoming ground operation in Rafah. But these airstrikes, they say, were actually cover for the rescue operation. The Israeli military says the two rescued hostages are in good condition. Health authorities in Gaza say at least 60 Palestinians were killed during the assault. Ada Peralta, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The U.S. has warned Israel against carrying out a full-scale offensive in Rafah without a plan to get more than 1 million Palestinian civilians to safety. Houston police say the female shooter who attacked Pastor Joel Osteen's megachurch yesterday used an AR-style semi-automatic rifle, on it a sticker with the word Palestine. Police say they found anti-Semitic writings at the woman's home, but motive remains unknown. She was killed by law enforcement. Two people were wounded, including a 7-year-old boy believed to be the shooter's son. For the third time in roughly a month, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is hospitalized at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, this time for a bladder-related issue. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
Secretary Austin is in the intensive care unit, undergoing a series of tests and evaluations, his doctors say. They say the current bladder issue is not expected to change the anticipated full recovery. It's not clear when he'll be released. Austin has canceled the trip this week to the NATO summit in Brussels. Austin entered the hospital for prostate surgery in late December, returning about a week later due to complications. Austin kept those visits secret for a time from the White House and Congress, and a review of the communication breakdown is under review by Austin's office and the Pentagon Inspector General. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
Tributes are pouring in for the late Radio Hall of Fame inductee Bob Edwards. For more than a generation, Edwards was the voice to which NPR listeners began their days when he hosted Morning Edition.
I'm Bob Edwards. Today is Monday, September 13th, and this is NPR's Morning Edition.
The Louisville native is being remembered as the consummate newsman who introduced listeners to some of the most compelling interviews and weekly conversation, including with sports broadcasting legend Red Barber. Connection to millions of listeners continued on XM Satellite Radio. He died Saturday at the age of 76. You're listening to NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Support for KMXT comes from Alaska's most advanced network. GCI's resilient and redundant network is keeping schools connected across the state. Details at gci.com/education.
The Kodiak History Museum has published an online photo database of thousands of items in its collection. As KMXT's Brian Venois reports, the project has taken museum staff a year and was published on January 31st.
The new database has been a long project for staff at the Kodiak History Museum. Chief Curator Margaret Greidart says it's taken over a year to document the condition of over 2,300 objects in the museum's storage.
The project kind of had two components. One is we wanted to photograph all of the objects in our collection, and then the second component is we wanted to make all of those photographs available online.
The museum used a $48,000 grant to pay for new camera equipment, lights, and a small studio to photograph the items as well as to pay staff for their time. Greidart says it was a tedious process to make sure every object was named and numbered correctly.
We got this really nice inventory list that we can just handy-dandy print that has all of the object IDs and the description on it. And then we were able to go down the list, photograph it, and then when you photograph on the camera, it'll assign it a photo number.
She says those photo numbers were then marked next to each item on their inventory to keep accurate labels. Lena Amison is one of the museum assistants who helped move and photograph the archives. She says she got to work with items deep in the museum's archive rooms.
I had to squeeze into this upstairs corridor and photograph oil lamps that were super heavy and impossible to move, but that we would have normally never gotten to see because they're way up and hidden away.
She says some of her favorite pieces were ivory otter charms that used to be carried by Aleutic hunters for good luck and safety. She says some of the most stressful parts were working with delicate pieces like a model kayak.
You wouldn't think you'd break a sweat photographing a teeny tiny lightweight object, but you can.
Greidart says taking photos of every object served another bigger purpose, though. The museum now has a visual record for its entire collection, including photos of the fronts, backs, and some details of every object. She noted despite the museum's efforts to preserve every item, the reality is that they can't preserve everything forever.
You can put them in the best conditions and some pigments just fade over 100 years or things like that. So there's some things that are just inevitable. So it's nice to have that snapshot in time.
The online database is up now, and staff are soliciting public opinion on how to proceed with writing captions. Greidart says she hopes it will spark more conversations about the role of cultural preservation.
One of our institutional values is transparency, and so we're trying to open the doors and show what we got.
She says she hopes to find another grant to do a similar project and publish all of the museum's photo collections as well. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
And for KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Two longtime King Cove residents died from injuries sustained in a suspicious fire in Anchorage at the start of the month. The fire is being investigated as arson, and the deaths are being investigated as homicides. James and Catherine Gould were owners of John Gould & Sons, the iconic King Cove General Store that first opened in 1939. The Goulds owned a home in Anchorage to be closer to family while traveling, according to a relative. The fire took place in a duplex home at the 3600 block of Young Street around 1:45 in the morning. Five other residents were referred to the Red Cross for assistance. The King County Medical Examiner's Office in Washington State listed Catherine Gould's manner of death as a homicide. An autopsy report for James Gould has not yet been released by the State of Alaska Medical Examiner's Office. An ongoing investigation between the Anchorage Police and Fire Department has not yet led to filed charges. Alaska lawmakers are searching for solutions to a looming shortage of natural gas that threatens power and heating for much of the state's population. As Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, the region's largest gas utility is warning that shortfalls could come as soon as next year, and imports are years away.
Alaska famously has tons of oil and gas. Getting it out of the ground to where it needs to be? Now that's a different story.
70% of the population live along the rail belt and depend on cook inlet gas.
That's Senator Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican and the chair of the Senate Energy Committee. Throughout South Central Alaska, heaters, stoves, and notably electric power plants rely on gas. Now, lots of the state's gas is up on the North Slope, but it's more or less stuck there until or unless the state builds a pipeline south, which would take longer than the state has time to wait, says Senator Bert Stedman, a Sitka Republican.
We can't wait 10 years, so we need to move forward.
That means continuing to rely on gas from Cook Inlet, and most of that comes from Hilcorp, the Texas-based oil and gas company that dominates the Cook Inlet Basin. And though the company says it plans to keep drilling, Hilcorp Senior Vice President Luc Sauget told a joint meeting of the House and Senate Resource Committees that they're expecting production to decline.
Part of the reason we're all here is because the gas under Hilcorp's leasehold cannot meet 100% of the demand that is there is today in the Cook Inlet market. So we need other sources of energy.
Not everyone buys that. Two Democrats on the committee suggested Hilcorp is not producing all it can, but Sauget says the company is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in drilling each year.
We're the only company that's drilled any wells since 2019. And I would submit to you that that's a problem. That's not a good situation for us to be in as a community, for the South Central Alaska community.
Sauget told the committee that sustained drilling is essential, since production starts to decline immediately after a new gas well is tapped. Hilcorp warned utilities in 2022 that it could not keep supplying gas at existing levels. Sauget says that's because it's only allowed to write contracts based on its proven reserves of gas, and it's expecting production to fall by nearly half over the next 5 years. ENSTAR, the South Central gas utility, told lawmakers that most electric utilities contracts with Hilcorp expire in 2027 and 2028, and it's unclear where gas will come from once they expire.
So that perspective is really important, and the more we slip on that, the worse this problem gets.
That's ENSTAR President John Sims. He says he's not confident there will be enough gas to meet demand next year. And he says gearing up to import gas from outside will take until at least 2030.
That is a scenario where everything goes absolutely correct, where we've expedited some permitting processes, and everything flows smoothly. So that was a big gulp and not something we had considered in the past, and places more emphasis on the discussion that we have today.
Sims says smaller-scale backup plans would triple current gas prices, and even once imports are online, he estimates prices would be 60% higher than they are now. So in the short term, the focus is on boosting production in Cook Inlet. And two smaller gas producers told the committee that they're facing significant hurdles in bringing new gas online.
We know the gas is there. There's no question. It is a matter of getting the funding to develop that gas.
Benjamin Johnson is the CEO of Blue Crest Energy, and he says he's struggling to raise the $400 million it would take to access a gas deposit off the coast of the southern Kenai Peninsula. An executive with another small producer, Hex, says high royalties on its gas field are holding back further drilling and asked lawmakers to provide relief. Lawmakers are considering a variety of bills that would provide incentives for drilling, including lower royalties. But would royalty relief go far enough towards increasing gas supplies from the region's overwhelmingly predominant producer? Hilcorp's Sauget says he's not sure if any of the circulating bills would do enough to push the company to drill more in the short term. Lawmakers are still exploring the best ways forward, but House Energy Committee Chair Representative Tom McKay, an Anchorage Republican, says he's confident they'll find a solution.
I think the public needs to realize that this is not a time to panic. This is not a time to get emotional. This is not a time to become irrational. We have lots of assets. We have lots of reserves. We have the capability to solve this problem in this building, and I believe we very well will do so.
More hearings on the issue are expected in the coming weeks. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
A man has died after he was caught in an avalanche during a heli-skiing trip in the Chugach Mountains. He was one of three people caught in slides this month, as forecasters warn of dangerous avalanche conditions across the region. The man killed has not yet been publicly identified by Alaska State Troopers, but they did say he was from Europe and dropped off with a group of skiers in the remote Lake George area near the Kinnick Glacier. The snowslide last Friday pushed him into rocks. He was flown to an Anchorage hospital with serious injuries and died soon after. On the same day, a snowboarder near Portage was carried 800 vertical feet when he was caught by another slide. He recorded the avalanche on his helmet camera, but escaped unharmed. Then a skier near Girdwood's Ragged Top Mountain was also hit by an avalanche and carried 30 to 40 feet, again without injuries. John Sykes is a forecaster with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. He says buried snow layers during this season's heavy snowfall have created a weak snowpack, which is causing avalanches in unexpected areas.
Higher elevation areas are tending to be more dangerous because of the recent winds. But that weak layer that I was talking about that's buried about 1 to 2 feet in the snowpack right now is actually a problem at all elevations.
Sykes says travelers in South Central Alaska's backcountry can be surprisingly close to dangerous areas, like the one where the heliskier died last Friday.
We're unique in that way in Alaska, where you can just walk 2 miles from Turning and Pass and be in this really extreme terrain where small avalanche can have high consequences.
The Avalanche Center is forecasting high avalanche danger near Turnagain Pass as heavy snow arrives in the area. Sykes says people should study avalanche forecasts and leave trip plans with somebody before heading into the backcountry. They should also bring avalanche airbags, beacons, and probes with them. Also, he says the weak snowpack means people should watch out for surface cracks from glide avalanches, as well as be wary of slides from tree-lined gaps or relatively shallow slopes. Law enforcement in Ketchikan last week seized 2 pounds of meth and almost 15,000 counterfeit pills containing fentanyl. The bust is linked to another seizure of nearly 10,000 pills back in January. As KRBD's Jack Darrell reports, it adds up to one of the largest drug busts in Ketchikan history.
Altogether, the two busts were worth about $1.7 million of the drugs sold on the street. Back in January, Ketchikan police arrested Andrew Hansen after they found about a half pound of powders containing meth and fentanyl. They also seized almost $15,000 in cash, a .38 special handgun, and nearly 10,000 counterfeit oxycodone pills containing fentanyl. Hansen was still behind bars on Tuesday when detectives carried out another seizure of nearly 15,000 fentanyl pills and approximately 2 pounds of meth. They say it's all part of the same investigation. And according to Alaska State Troopers, the seized fentanyl is about 38,000 fatal doses, enough to kill every one of the 14,000 people on Revilla Island multiple times over. Trooper spokesman Austin McDaniel said in an email that, besides Hansen, no additional charges have been filed. The flow of fentanyl into Ketchikan has become a major pain point in the community. Members of the Alaska National Guard were also in Ketchikan this week. They were deployed to brief the community on fentanyl. They held a community meeting at the Ted Ferry Civic Center.
Unresponsive at this time. ETA about 2 minutes any further.
The briefing began with the National Guard showing attendees a short film by Dominic Tierno called Dead on Arrival. Sergeant Elijah Gutierrez is a civil operator with the National Guard's counter-drug support program.
Who here knows someone, a loved one, a relative, or just someone around who's died from overdose?
Nearly everyone in the crowd put their hands up. Gutierrez then broke the news about the day's bust.
20,000 pills for Ketchikan tonight that aren't here, but others are getting through. You're being targeted because a pill here costs $100 versus $10 in Anchorage. It's very lucrative to sell pills here.
He said the goal tonight is prevention through education. Gutierrez referenced something a Ketchikan high school student said to him to demonstrate the severity of the situation.
You can't even try it. You can't even try. You can't even try to experiment with drugs because you just don't know what's in them and you don't know if you're going to die. And I was like, job done. If a high school student knows about that, has the information and is aware of it, that's hope.
The Ketchikan Wellness Coalition also took the stage to talk about youth prevention. Director Jackie Yates said the coalition uses federal grants to bring drug prevention instruction to local schools. The coalition will also be holding an event in May where parents can walk through a mock high schooler's staged bedroom and attempt to spot hidden signs of drug and alcohol misuse. One resident asked if the video was being shown at the local warming shelter to educate the homeless population. Yates says the island's homeless population is not necessarily the targeted audience.
I think it's also poignant to note that the majority of people who are consuming fentanyl are actually not homeless individuals, which is really shocking as well. It is far more prevalent outside of that population just based on price and access.
Another concern raised was whether the local police and the National Guard are testing seized fentanyl for xylazine. That's a veterinary sedative that, when mixed with fentanyl, increases fatality. Xylazine makes naloxone, or Narcan, the standard treatment for someone overdosing on an opioid like fentanyl, not work. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration reported in 2022 that nearly a quarter of all fentanyl tested positive for xylazine. Ketchikan Police Chief Jeff Walls said he isn't aware of any statistics on xylazine, but the fentanyl on the island is getting stronger, enough so that they increased the standard Narcan dosage administered by the island's emergency responders.
We are seeing an increase in the potency of the fentanyl. Is that either way, what we're looking at is it's a death sentence, you know, and that's we want to get it off the street, so...
The Alaska National Guard also told Ketchikan first responders that their unit can assist with the community's fight against fentanyl in the future. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
The city of Anchorage has reached a legal settlement with the organization that sued it over the lengthy amount of time it took to outfit police officers with body cameras. The Alaska Black Caucus, a local advocacy group, filed the lawsuit against the city in April of last year over the failure to put body-worn cameras on police officers 2 years after voters approved a $1.8 million tax hike for their purchase and implementation. In a settlement filed on Friday in state superior court, the city of Anchorage and the Alaska Black Caucus agreed to set a deadline of August 1st of this year to require all patrol officers to wear body cameras when in uniform and on duty. Alaska Black Caucus President Celeste Hodge Groudon says the group couldn't be happier with the firm deadline.
That's all we ever wanted, was to get what we voted for, and that was to outfit our officers with body cams.
Additionally, the city of Anchorage will pay the Alaska Black Caucus $5,000 and cover its legal costs from the suit. Hodge Groudon says her organization is now focused on making sure access to the body camera footage is easy and available for the public. The current policy gives the police chief the sole authority to preemptively release footage of critical incidents like police shootings before an investigation wraps up.
The fact that, you know, it's up to one individual to decide if what footage is going to be released, if it's going to be released, and, you know, having to secure through a records request and the amount of money that it would cost to get the footage. It's just mind-boggling to us.
After months of negotiations with the police union, Anchorage Police Department finalized their body-worn camera policy in May of last year and began outfitting officers with cameras in mid-November. APD officials did not respond to questions on Friday about how many officers currently have the cameras. However, in early December, officials said 54 of 350 officers had been outfitted and trained. At the time, Deputy APD Chief Sean Case said the department was able to install about 4 cameras a day on officers and their vehicles.
Just a quarter of economists in a new survey think there'll be a recession this year. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Minute. More than half the economists in the latest poll from the National Association for Business Economics say we won't have a recession until next year or later. Two Texas oil producers announced plans to merge today. The deal between Diamondback Energy and Endeavor Energy Resources is valued at about $26 billion. According to Reuters, the new company would be the third biggest oil and gas producer in the Permian Basin, which straddles Texas and New Mexico. The Senate is back in session today after voting yesterday to move forward on a package of aid for Israel, Ukraine, and other countries. There could be a final Senate vote on the bill this week. Its fate in the House is unclear. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 12th day of February, the year 2024. The sun rose today at 8:47. It will set again at exactly 6 p.m., giving us 9 hours and 13 minutes of glorious daylight. A gain of 4 minutes and 45 seconds compared to yesterday. A record high temperature for this date was 60 degrees set in 1923, and a record low was 3 degrees set in 1921. Currently a relatively warm 42 degrees in Kodiak. It's foggy and misty. In fact, at the airport, they are claiming only 4 miles of visibility at the present time, as well as southeast winds steady at 13, gusting to 24. Those southeasterly winds are expected to gust heavily and mightily all day today, tonight, and tomorrow, too, gusting as high as 35 today, 45 tonight, and as high as 50 miles per hour tomorrow. Look for rain throughout the period, too, and highs around 42, overnight lows about 37. We have an incoming tide. Our next high tide here on the east side will happen at 3:33 this afternoon and be 9.5 feet. That'll be followed by a significant low tide at 9:49 p.m., 10 minutes to 10. That will be a minus 1.2-foot tide here on the east side. Anyone who has a boat tied up that might hang up. Over on the west side, your high tide will happen at 4:06 this afternoon and be 15.5 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a low tide at 10:27 p.m., about 10:30, and that's going to be a minus 1.8-foot tide in Larsen Bay. Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Gale warning for tonight and tomorrow. For today, southeast 30, seas building to 19 feet this afternoon. For tonight, southeast 35 with 19-foot seas. And for tomorrow, southeast 40 with 20-foot seas. That weather is not expected to improve much for the rest of the week. For Wednesday, southeast 35 and 20-foot seas. And Thursday and Friday, northeast 30 with seas to 22 feet. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tomorrow. East winds to 30 knots, becoming southeast 30 tonight. Seas to 8 feet today, tonight, and tomorrow. East 30 tomorrow. For Wednesday, look for east winds to 30 knots, coming down to east 25 on Thursday. 8-foot seas on Wednesday, coming down to 6 feet on Thursday on the west side. The senior citizens of Kodiak are once again in need of paper bags. Please make sure they are not torn or soiled. They can be dropped off at the senior center between the hours of 8:30 and 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. Things happening at the library include the Lego Club at 3:30 p.m. on Wednesday. Children under 10 must be accompanied by an adult. And Tuesdays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., that's tomorrow, is the Loffy and Chill. Unwind with calming lights, Loffy tunes, and a relaxing atmosphere. Ideal for a focused study or hanging out with friends for ages 13 and above. The following are upcoming Kodiak Island Borough public meetings. On Monday, February 12th, the Health Facilities Advisory Board will be having its regular meeting in the Providence Conference Room at 3 p.m. On Wednesday, February 14th, the Planning and Zoning Commission will be holding its work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. On Thursday, February 15th, the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having its regular meeting in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. All meetings are open to the public, and the meeting packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough's website. Please contact the Borough Clerk's Office with any questions at 907-486-9310. Notice is hereby given. There will be a Board of Education work session on Thursday, beginning at 6:30 p.m. in the District Services Conference Room, which is number F-140 of the old high school wing. Meeting agenda and packets are available at the Kodiak Island Borough School District's website under Board Docs. For more information, contact the Secretary to the Board of Education at 907-486-7566. And the senior citizens of Kodiak's Island Cove Adult Day Program has been helping families care for their elders for over 35 years. Adult day services provide relief for the family, reduce isolation for the adult, and offer a fun and stimulating place to spend a few hours in a safe environment. Have you considered adult day services for your mother, father, or spouse? For information, call 907-486-2203 or visit the Senior Center website at www.kodiakseniorcenter.com.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.